Good morning. What a joy to be together as brethren in Christ, to be encouraged and strengthened as we have this opportunity again to just see what the Lord has done in a man that has been gifted to contend for the faith. I'm going to share one bit of scripture from Jude's letter, and we see that Jude was desiring to write about the common salvation that we all have. And he says, "I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. For certain men have crept in unnoticed who long ago were marked out for this condemnation, ungodly men who turn the grace of our God into lewdness and deny the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ." And before Dinesh begins, we're going to show a clip of Christopher Hitchens, who is one of his opponents in a debate. And I think you're going to see what a fool Christopher Hitchens is. As Scripture says, the fool says in his heart that there is no God. But I also want you to note how forceful and precise he is. So at this point, we'll begin with a clip of Christopher Hitchens and then Dinesh.
What else should I say, the time I've got left, that Christianity is, as well as untrue, immoral? Well, it offers something horrible, vicarious redemption. You're told that by applauding a human sacrifice, a particularly cruel and revolting one, that took place before you were born to fulfill a prophecy in which you had no say, condemns you either to punishment and sin if you don't accept it, or if you do accept it, offers you the chance that your own sins can be forgiven you. Well, everything is wrong with this picture. First, as with the original proposition of a deity, it requires of you compulsory love as well as compulsory fear. You have to simultaneously love someone, you're commanded to love them, and be frightened of them at the same time. This is no way to teach morals. Second, you're told not that you might get a second chance, but or that your debts can be paid. I can pay your debts if I care enough for you. I could serve your time in prison if I wished. But I can't forgive you the sin. I can't absolve you of the responsibility of what you've already done. I can't wash you white as snow. And the desire to be washed in that way and to be free of responsibility is itself an immoral one and should be rejected by anyone with any, I'll repeat the term, with any self-respect. So the vicarious redemption by human sacrifice is an immoral preachment with very immoral implications, as is compulsory love coupled with compulsory fear. The idea that the laws of nature can be suspended in your favor if you make the right propitiations is a lie. Dinesh points out what a lie it is. Einstein says how marvelous it is. The great thing about the universe is its laws never are suspended. They are never suspended. They do operate according to a beauty, a logic, and a symmetry that we don't quite yet understand. We're getting to understand them better. Dinesh points it out rather intelligently to you. What does Christianity say? Ah, those laws can be suspended, and in your favor, too, if you make the right prayers and propitiations and sacrifices. There can be a virgin can conceive, a dead body can walk again, your leprosy can be cured, the blind can see. Nonsense. It's not moral to lie to children. It's not moral to lie to ignorant, uneducated people and to tell them that if they will only believe nonsense, they can be saved. It's immoral.
Dinesh, this is your opportunity. Stand against.
Hello, everyone. Good morning. And it's really good to be back. I know there are some people who are new, but I'm going to cover some quite new ground from some of the themes that I talked about yesterday. I want to come back and address some of the topics that Christopher Hitchens referred to, but I'm not going to do so right away. I do want to highlight a couple of things that are notable about the new atheism that I think you saw a little glimpse of. in this short clip. The first is the new atheism is different than the arguments that we've had over the past 20 or 30 years. If you listened, for example, to Madeleine Murray O'Hare 25 years ago, she was talking about things like, let's take the monument of the Ten Commandments down from the Alabama state capitol. It was a debate about church and state. And so for a lot of Christians, they, in a sort of spirit of gentleness, the Christian would say, well, you know what, maybe we should take the monument down. Or to put it differently, let's keep the public square neutral. We'll practice our faith in private. The problem with this kind of a treaty is that the new atheists have come along and they said, well, we're not content to take the Ten Commandments down from the Alabama state capitol. We're not content to leave Christianity alone in the private sphere. We're going to go into the private sphere and attack it there. We want to root it out completely. So the agenda of the new atheism isn't confined to privatizing religion. It really wants to eradicate the influence of God from Western society and indeed from the world. I think the second thing about this new atheism is in some ways it requires a little bit of a, you might say, a new apologetics. And what I mean by that is that there have been, through history, great Christian apologists. The writer Pascal, in his book called Ponce, C.S. Lewis, very famously in the last century. But you have to remember that each generation of apologists is responding to questions of that time. C.S. Lewis wrote books with titles like The Problem of Pain. Now, why that book? Because he was writing around the time of World War II. And right after the war, many people would say things like, oh my gosh, how would a just God, a compassionate God, allow something like a Holocaust? And so Christian apologetics in the mid part of the 20th century was kind of aimed at addressing those kinds of questions. But if you'll notice, in listening a little bit to Hitchens, and I could elaborate further on his themes, the voice of the new atheism is different. So when you listen to an argument by a guy like Dawkins or Hitchens or Daniel Dennett, you can't say, okay, I'll go read C.S. Lewis and get the answer to that, because C.S. Lewis wasn't confronted with those types of questions then. I just debated Hitchens in Vegas, and I want to add one argument to the one he made here. He made a rather startling argument that I had to really think about to answer. He said, if you really think about it, the Christian God is really a horrible character. He said, think about it. Human beings have been on the planet for a long, long time. Let's say, we can argue about it, but it's thousands and thousands of, let's say 50,000 years. So what has your God been doing all this time? Well, for the first 45,000 years of humanity, things were really horrible. There were brutal wars, primitive raids on tribes, there was massacres, people had rotting teeth, infant mortality, people were dropping dead at the age of 30. He says, where was God? God was basically sitting around enjoying the show, doing nothing. He says, then about 5,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, God says, well, you know what? I'm getting a little bored over here. Time to get involved. But I won't go to China or Egypt or India, to Babylon. You have all these civilizations that have emerged. I'll ignore them. I'll find some God-forsaken shepherd in the middle of nowhere named Abraham. I'll go whisper in his ear, and the news won't get to China for another 2,000 years. He goes, what kind of a whacked out God is this? Who behaves like this? So what I'm saying is this is the pungent voice of the new atheism. And there's nothing in existing Christian apologetics to answer it completely. I'm going to, this morning, we want to make this a kind of interactive question and answer session. So I'm not going to be too windy. I'm just going to really focus on three or four key themes And then I'm going to kind of open it up to a kind of Q&A, which I think will actually be very lively. The questions coming from you and from some people who were here yesterday. I want to begin with a little piece of kind of good news. And that is that when we see this new atheism, it sometimes seems very discouraging because it seems like, oh gosh, you know, we used to live in a Christian society. We're living in the secular culture. These atheists are becoming more and more bold and militant. And there is some data to support this, that the number of self-professed atheists in America has really gone up. It used to be that you could never go to a cocktail party 15 years ago and hear some guy go, well, yeah, I'm an atheist. And not only am I an atheist, I'm actually a much better guy than you believers. So this self-confident atheism is a little bit new. On the other hand, in a weird way, it is a response, I think, not to the success of atheism, but in some ways to the success of religion worldwide. Because when I was in college 25 years ago, we learned something that is called, widely believed in academia, called the secularization thesis. And the basic idea is really simple. As society becomes more educated and more technological and more scientific, religion will wither away because people will get smart and they will stop believing in such stupid things. So this idea was verified by the experience of Europe. It is true that as Europe became more modern and more affluent and more scientific, religion has withered away to a large degree. But this expectation, which was universal, that this would happen to everybody, has proven to be completely untrue. First of all, America has not gone the way of Europe. America is in some ways more modern, more technological, in some respects more affluent, but America remains perhaps the most religious society in the Western world. And in the rest of the world, if you look at the newly modernizing societies of China and India and so on, modernization is in no way producing secularization. In fact, in other societies, you know, it's generally true, even in America, that if you find a group of PhDs, they tend to be less religious than, say, guys who have a high school degree. On the average, that's true. But it's not true in any other culture. So what's really happened is that the atheists were sort of sitting around thinking, hey, we don't have to do anything. Society is automatically going to move in our direction. But suddenly, in the last 25 years, they've woken up. They've seen an Islamic revival. They've seen Hinduism growing in India. And they have seen Christianity spreading in the world. This, by the way, is a big surprise even to many Christians who think that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. Not true. The fastest growing religion in the world is Christianity. In fact, Islam is mainly growing through reproduction. Muslims having big families. But Christianity is growing through reproduction and conversion and is spreading rapidly in places like Asia and Africa. There are countries in Africa that used to have 1% Christian 100 years ago and are now 50% Christian. So you've seen huge explosions. So the atheists are smart. They know this stuff. They look around the world and go, whoops, it's really not going our way. I see some of the belligerence of the new atheism as a response to that. The atheists have said, wait a minute, we've got to sort of actively, we've got to develop, you can call it evangelical atheism. We've got to be missionaries for our cause. You know, it's not insignificant that Hitchens mentioned, it's not right to lie to children. Because one of the very, I think in some ways, insidious ideas being cultivated by the new atheists is that parents don't have the right to inculcate religious values in their own children. Why? Because that's a form of child abuse. The basic idea here is you should allow children to develop an open-mindedness so they can decide for themselves based on evidence. But when you try to train their mind religiously, fill it with all kinds of dogma, you are actually doing them a grave disservice. Now, so this is the background, if you will, to what's happening here. Yesterday, I spoke a little bit about science, and I want to come back to that a little bit because I want to address the issue raised by Christopher Hitchens about miracles. Miracles, by the way, are important in only one religion, namely Christianity. Miracles occur in other religions, but they are not central. For example, Judaism has miracles. Islam has some miracles. But if you took out the miracles, basically the religion would remain the same. Christianity is not like that. Christ is defined in some ways by the healings of the sick and by the raising of Lazarus. And of course, by the central miracle of Christianity, the resurrection. Paul says, if you remove the resurrection, our faith is in vain. So in some ways, it is more incumbent upon Christians to defend the possibility of miracles than anyone else. For other religions, it's not critical. Interestingly, this issue of miracles is so problematic for Christians that there is a whole brand of liberal Christianity in which many theologians will concede the miracles never happened. In fact, these are theologians teaching in divinity schools, and if you say to them, well, what about the story of the loaves and the fishes? They'll say things like, well, actually people brought boxed lunches. They'll say the real miracle was that when Christ waved his hands, everybody took out their boxed lunch and shared. And the miracle was the sharing. Or you say, well, what about this business about, you know, walking on the water? And they go, well, actually, there was a hidden platform below the waves. So it was actually pretty easy to walk. So this is sort of, you could call it Christian acquiescence or surrender. You save Christianity by surrendering its key ideas. What about the resurrection? Wasn't Christ raised from the dead? Well, actually, no. But you see, the miracle was that his disciples believed he was. And that belief was so inspirational to them and so on. So this is the Christianity that responds to criticism by basically giving in. I'm going to come back to miracles in just a second. I want to talk for a moment about science because the key idea here is to get to the root of it. The atheist is saying, look, science is based on facts. Religion is based on faith. Facts are, you might say, real. They're verifiable. We can check them out. That's a more reliable way of having knowledge than someone just telling you something or you reading it in a holy book. You don't know if it's really true. You're believing it even though you don't know. Now, although you often have this great contrast between fact and, you might say, belief, or between evidence and faith, I actually want to argue that this is a little bit of a false dichotomy, that actually science also is based on faith. In fact, science is based on three faith-based propositions that can in no way be supported by evidence and come directly from Christian theology. Now, what are these three propositions? Number one, the universe is rational. Now, just sort of reflect on this for just a moment, because if you think about it, it's a little bit odd. I mean, you or I can be rational. We have brains. The universe, as far as we know, does not possess a brain. How can a universe be rational? But modern science is based on the premise that it is. Second, the universe, in a sense, you might say, obeys laws. Or the operations of the universe are describable in lawful terms. Not just any laws, the laws of mathematics. This is also bizarre. Why? Because you and I can obey laws. When we're driving on a street, we see a stop sign, we stop. But that's because we are purposeful, intentional agents. How can inanimate objects follow rules? You only have to go to other cultures to see how ridiculous this seems. There's a Muslim thinker, great philosopher Al-Ghazali, and he says, are you telling me that the electron knows what to do? Are you telling me that inanimate objects can follow laws? He says, it's ridiculous. He goes, there are no laws. The whole universe exists in the mind of Allah. Everything happens at every second because Allah decrees it should happen. There's no other way it could happen. Interestingly, it's only in Western civilization that you have this idea of a lawful universe. There's a physicist, Eugene Wigner, a Nobel Prize winner, who wrote an essay about 25 years ago called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics, in which he was saying how odd it is that the operations of nature can be somehow described in the terms of E equals MC squared or pi R squared and all these mathematical rules. Why should it be so? Third, not only is the universe rational, not only is the universe lawful, the third fact is the strangest of all, that the rationality of the universe out there is mirrored in the operations or rationality of our own minds. Now, if you think about this, this is the most peculiar fact of all. And why? Because your brain is made up of atoms and molecules and neurons and circuits. So why the heck should all the worrying that's going on in here kind of match up with the operations of the world out there? Why should there even be a connection or correspondence between the two? What is the reason? There is no reason. So here's what I'm getting at. If you are a believer, if you are a Christian, you can say, well, you know what? These strange facts actually make a lot of sense to me. The universe is rational. That's because it was created by a omniscient or super rational God. So he made a rational universe. The universe is lawful. That's because God is a lawgiver. He gave us the moral law, hey, the Ten Commandments. He's also given us the physical laws of nature. And we are created in God's image, in the divine image. So we have a hint of that divine stamp on us. So it's not surprising that we have within us that spark of rationality to comprehend the rationality of the world. But here's my point. If you are an atheist, you can't make any of these assumptions. You have to take them 100% on faith. And without that faith, what we call modern science would be completely impossible. Okay. Now what about... I'll come to miracles in a second. I want to make one other point. I said yesterday that there are remarkable findings in modern science that support not just the idea of a creator, but in some ways the very Christian idea of a creator. I told you about one yesterday, the so-called fine-tuned universe. I want to tell you about another this morning. And I'll tell you about it this way. About 1,500 years ago, somebody posed a rather interesting question to the church father Augustine. This is the author of Augustine's Confessions. And the question goes like this. If you think about time, time goes back. But no matter how far back you go, you can always go further back. So if some guy goes 5,000 years ago, you can say, well, before that it was 5,001 years ago. 10,000 years ago, before that, 10,001 years ago. 1,000,000 years ago, 1,000,001 years ago. So it's really hard to envision time as, in a sense, not stretching almost infinitely far back into the past. And the question was, so did God create the universe? And if he did, what was God doing before he created the universe? How did God occupy his time, which he evidently had a great deal of, prior to creating the universe? Now, to this question, Augustine gave, based on a meditation on scripture, a rather astounding answer. He said, actually, God created time along with the universe. In other words, before the universe, and you kind of have to put the word before in quote marks, there was no time. Once upon a time, time did not exist. Now, this is a kind of a mind-bending idea. And yet, today, If you dispatch your 17-year-old daughter or son to an introductory physics course at UC Irvine or UC San Diego, they will learn in the first 6 weeks that as a direct consequence of what is called the Big Bang, the origin of the universe, not only did the universe have a beginning, which is to say, not only did all of matter have a beginning, but space and time also had a beginning. Space and time are properties of our universe. So, what I'm getting at is that modern science, in a rather bizarre way, has come around to something that was stated as a biblical proposition almost 2,000 years ago. Remember, Augustine was not a scientist. He didn't say, I've done some experiments and I've concluded. No, he basically said, based on the revealed word of God, I'm telling you that this is how it happened. And I'm saying 2,000 years later, modern science has come to agree with him. Not only did space and time have a beginning, the laws of nature had a beginning. Outside of the universe, there are no laws of nature. And some people say, well, what does that even mean? Well, here's what it means. When you think of the laws of nature, you can think of them as a kind of a grammar. You know, when you ask yourself this question, can you have language? Can you have grammar without language? No. Why? Because grammar describes the operations of language, the relationship between nouns and verbs and so on. So similarly, what we call the laws of nature are the grammar that describe the operations of the objects in the universe. No universe, no laws of physics. Okay, now let me turn specifically to miracles. This is a topic that actually came up in a very blunt way in my debate with Hitchens, in which I answered his point about miracles in the following way. I said to him, you've mentioned these inviolable laws of nature, these laws of nature that have no exceptions. Because think about it, if the laws of nature were inviolable, miracles would be impossible. The whole idea of a miracle is in some ways a suspension or exception to the laws of nature. So I asked Hitchens, I said, okay, let's have you name for me a law of physics or of science that you know admits of no exceptions. So he thought about it for a minute, and he said, I can't name a single one. Now, this seems odd. Let me clarify. Why can't he name a single one? Well, because there aren't any. Now, why aren't there any? Why aren't there any? It seems the universe is lawful. How could we send people to the moon? How would airplanes fly? And so on. But let's back up and look for just a moment at what we mean by a scientific law. Let's take one of the most basic laws of science that no science would be possible today in a modern sense without it. Let's say the speed of light in a vacuum is 186,000 miles a second. Key principle or law of science. Okay, let's ask ourselves this question. How do we know that? How do you know that that is true in every case? Turns out, you know it by measurement. You measure light one time, and two times, and five times, and 1,000 times, and 1,000,000 times. Now, the philosopher David Hume, about 200 years ago, a great skeptic, by the way, made this point. He said that no amount of empirical measurements of anything, no matter how large, can ever lead to a general principle that is true in every case. Here's why. Okay, we measure light one time, two times, three times, 1,000 times. So what? How do you know that on a star 5 light years away, light over there travels at the same speed? How do you know? Have you been there? Have you measured it over there? No, you just think that because it goes so fast over here, it must go so fast over there. But you're only guessing. You don't know that. You're presuming that this speed of light will be replicated everywhere in the universe at the same speed. But we don't know that to be true. In fact, there are numerous cases in science of things that were believed to be flat out true, confirmed many times and found to be false. The most famous example in the West is the example that has to do with white swans. For, by the way, about 1,500 years in Western civilization, it was believed that all swans are white. Why? Because every swan ever seen by a white man was always white. And in fact, you can look at poetry stretching for hundreds of years, which refers to white as a swan. Then a few hundred years ago, a white man set foot on the shores of Australia, only to observe for the very first time black swans. And the moment you see black swans, in fact, the moment you see one black swan, you now know that your law, all swans are white, is in fact false. It only takes a single exception to overturn the rule. So the point I'm trying to get at here, really, and it's a point worth pondering a little bit, is that scientific laws are not laws. They are actually generalized observations based on previous tries. They are only laws until we find an exception that overturns the previous rule. They are provisional guesses. So my point is, if scientific laws are not inviolable, if we don't know them to be inviolable, then miracles are possible. This doesn't mean miracles are likely. In fact, Christians don't believe miracles are likely. That's why we call them miracles. Now, I've talked a little bit about science. I know there's going to be some questions. I'm going to come back to those. I'm going to move a little bit ahead. I want to talk a little bit about this issue of the war on terror. And the reason I want to say a word about this is because if you really think about what has given this new atheism a kind of, what's allowed it to take off? What's given it a real ring in the popular culture? Essentially, the new atheists have taken full advantage of 9/11. What they've basically said, and Hitchens is pretty eloquent on this point, is they basically said that religious societies become warlike. They become very dangerous. And secular societies are much better. They're more peaceful. In fact, we should fight in defense of secular values against the radical Muslims. Now, ironically, the idea here, by the way, is the idea that the radical Muslims are against Christianity. Christians are against them. We've been fighting for centuries. Now, at the end of the Cold War, we're resuming this crazy conflict. It's going to end up blowing up the world. Basically, we need to get away from all this. But ironically, in the last few years, I've actually done a three-year study of the leading thinkers of radical Islam. Kind of interested in the question of how has radical Islam, which was actually, by the way, at one time a rather marginal force, but now it's become a real political force. Those guys have been able to recruit very effectively. They even have won some free elections, Hamas in Gaza, the victories of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and so on. So what are the radical Muslims saying to the ordinary Muslim on the street? Interestingly, when you look at the propaganda of radical Islam, you discover, I expected to see, oh, these horrible Christians, they've done this, they've done that. But you can verify for yourself. Go listen to the Bin Laden videos. How many times does he describe America or the West as Christian? And the answer is very, very rarely. Almost always, you'll notice, he condemns the West as pagan. And one of the terms that Khomeini made famous a generation ago, America is not accused of being the great Christian society. It's accused of being the great Satan. The historian Bernard Lewis once said that Satan, in the Abrahamic tradition that's common to Islam and Christianity and Judaism, Satan is not really normally a conqueror. He's not a military guy. Satan is kind of a tempter, a seducer. And the argument of the radical Muslims, in a way, is very cunning. We often hear in American society that the radical Muslims are upset because, you know, the Palestinians don't have a state, or because America invaded Iraq, or because there are U.S. troops in Mecca. But if you think about it, this stuff doesn't make that much sense. Because here's an ordinary Muslim in Morocco or the Sudan or Somalia. Why does that guy want to put bullets on his chest and go kill himself? Because the Palestinians, 2,000 miles away, don't have a state? Doesn't make that much sense. What the radical Muslims are saying to that ordinary Muslim is something totally different. It's basically this. Islam is under attack. And it's under attack not from Christians. It's under attack from a Western society that used to be Christian but is now completely pagan. This Western society, in the name of atheism, wants to impose its secular and atheist way of life on the whole world. And in doing so, wants to destroy what can be called traditional morality. In other words, the Muslim family, the innocence of the Muslim children. Essentially, what America represents in the minds of the radical Muslims is atheism and immorality. And the argument is not America's not content to be atheist and immoral at home. It now wants to project these values worldwide, partly through its military force, but mainly through the influence of its popular culture. Now, interestingly, this argument is striking a chord on the Muslim street, not because it is completely true, but because it is verified by the images of America that people abroad often see. To give you a small example of this, my mom, who's in her early 70s, came to America about 3 years ago and was visiting us in San Diego. And she said, I'd like to go to church. And I said, Mom, we should go a little bit early because of parking. So we get there and we're driving up and down. And she looks around and she goes, where are all these people going? She sees all the cars, rows upon rows. And I say, well, they're going to church. And my mom was completely shocked. Why? Because her idea of America was nobody goes to church. And where did she get that idea? She got that idea from American movies and American TV shows and American serials, American music. In other words, if you look at the images of American popular culture, you can see why it's not that hard for the radical Muslims to say, hey, look, this is a shameless, depraved society. These are the kinds of values that they call freedom. This is the kind of lifestyle that they want to make our children live. So, here's my point to Christopher Hitchens. Far from Christianity being the provocation or the problem, the way the radical Muslims see it, it's really secularism and atheism that is the problem. That is what is making America, you might say, the object of radical Muslim propaganda. I offer this just as food for thought. I've written a whole book on this called The Enemy at Home. All right. I now want to conclude, because I want to go to questions, by talking a little bit about this issue of atonement that Hitchens raises about how it's Christ and how it's wrong and, you might say, immoral to pay for somebody else's sins. Let me cast the problem in a slightly different light, because if you really think about it, and this is, by the way, also a good way to think about the question that we are often asked as Christians, well, what makes your religion different? Why do you think your way is better? And remember that you can never answer a question like that by, you can call it internal evidence. Internal evidence means, well, my way is better because the Gospel of Matthew says that he who really believes will be saved. Because the Muslim answer to that is, well, and it says right here in the Quran, Surah 24, that he who calls on the name of Allah will be saved. Who wins that argument? Two people lose it. Both sides. The bottom line is you've got to give an account that is accessible to the other guy. So, here's what I'm getting at. In some ways, I think whether we are believers or secular, we can all agree that there's a kind of a human problem. And the human problem is this, that in life, we all want to be better. We believe in beauty and goodness and truth and justice. But we always fall short of that. Our standard is over here, and our life is over here. Big gap. You might say this is the divine level of perfection, and this is the human level down here. Now, In some ways, all religions in the world can be understood as efforts to close the gap. How can man, down here, flawed, reach, you might say, the level of the divine, the level of true beauty and true perfection? Now, essentially, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, all are efforts to construct a ladder that will take you from here up here. The Jewish and Islamic solutions are remarkably similar. They involve diet, they involve regulatory codes, they involve a set of commandments, and the idea is that if you follow these rules, you can start slowly ascending the ladder. The solutions of Hinduism and Buddhism are remarkably similar to each other. And the basic problem is that human nature is deeply and inherently selfish. It's focused on the I, me. And the Buddhist and Hindu solution is, you know, if you could only find a way to eradicate the I, in some ways commit, you might say, spiritual suicide, wipe yourself out, then somehow the sky would clear and you would have nirvana, or you would have some sort of experience of perfection. So the idea is to remove this I that gets in the way of everything. But if you put all four together, they're all saying the same thing. We've got a ladder, we've got some rules and techniques, the five ways, the seven ways, and to help you get up the ladder. Now, Christianity, I think, is unique in that it basically proclaims in advance that no matter how elaborate these techniques and how high the ladder, it's not going to get you there. The chasm between the human level and the divine level is too big for man to scale. That it may be that it cannot be scaled. And that's sort of, you could say, atheist hopelessness. You basically give up on the project and you say, well, that's just wishful thinking and aspiration. We'll never get there because we are evolved primates. Let's just face it and live with it. That's one way to go. But the Christian view is that if this chasm can be scaled, it can only be scaled from above. In other words, the only way to cross it would be in some ways for God, for some transcendent being to reach down to the human level and cross that barrier himself. So Christ, I think, can be seen as the effort, God's enterprise, you might say, of reaching down into humanity and bridging this awesome and otherwise unbridgeable gap. So the idea here is, from a secular, you might say, anthropological viewpoint, just to say to people like Hitchens, okay, you admit there's a gap, this huge gap, that otherwise couldn't be crossed. If it can be crossed, this is the only way it could happen. The other ways might get us from A to B, but they're not going to get us from A to Z. They're not going to get us all the way to where we need to be. So, I'm going to come back and address these themes a little bit further. I realize I'm running a little bit over on time, so I'm going to close this way. And that is, it seems to me today there's a task as Christians that it would seem a little bit odd. But we've got to, in some ways, learn to think more like the atheist. Why? Because then you can get a hold of the force of what the atheist is trying to say. And you can more effectively answer what the atheist is saying on his own terms. Too often we become really defensive. Particularly a guy like Hitchens has been very effective in debates because he throws his Christian opponent off because he makes such scandalous statements that you become angry and defensive and begin to blabber. But it's actually easier to stay calm and listen to the thrust of what he's trying to say. At one point, and I'll probably end on this note, he said in our debate, he said, you know, heaven, he said, I really don't want to go there. He said, it's a horrible place. I think I mentioned yesterday, he said, it's like celestial North Korea. It's unending tyranny. All human tyranny at least ends with death. But heaven never ends. It's horrible. I came back and I said, well, right here you get a little bit of an insight, because atheists are always accusing Christians of having this angry God who grabs the atheist and flings him into hell for his misdeeds. And I said, but no, it's not like that at all. You know, we read in Scripture that salvation is the gift of God. And many people think, oh, this means that God gives us the gift of salvation. No, actually the Bible doesn't say salvation is the gift from God. Salvation is the gift of God. God is the gift. The point being that if a Christopher Hitchens says, I don't want heaven, I don't want God, I reject that, God is reluctantly granting that wish. In other words, what I'm saying is the gates of hell are locked from the inside. It's not a fact of God grabbing the atheist and condemning him. It's the atheist is voluntarily, not by compulsory love, but by free will. If this enterprise was compulsory, how would Hitchens be free to be an atheist? But he's using that freedom to say, I don't want God. And since God does give us the free will, including the will to reject him, ultimately we can understand hell as a voluntary decision on the part of a free individual to want nothing to do with God, and God reluctantly grants that wish. Now, I'll end on this thought. For Christians, challenges like this are always also opportunities. They're opportunities because in some ways, in a church, we can become a little bit sleepy, a little bit complacent. So in some ways, I even welcome the new atheism because I think, you know what? It's going to make us as Christians go back to first principles. It's going to make us really think, how do we know that to be true? How can we defend this? How does this make sense just from a human point of view? How do we communicate? Our pastors say, go talk to your neighbors and your coworkers and your friends. But very often you say, well, how do I do that? If I go approach a guy who's Jewish, he's going to say, well, how do you know Christ was the Messiah? How do you know that? So in some ways, I think there's a real opportunity here for Christians to start thinking for the first time in a long time. Since the 60s, a lot of Christianity has been experiential, which is basically just the experience of Christ. And I think that's revitalized the church and an important part, but not the only part. In some ways, I think we need to also develop our minds here. So if we do that, if we take advantage of this opportunity, I think at the end of the day, we might be praying in a rather peculiar way. Thank God for the new atheism. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dinesh. We've certainly been drawn to think a little bit more clearly and provoked to recognize that there are those in the world today that are raising new questions. And this morning we've been able to collate a number of the questions thus far, and so we're going to bring these out as the audience is. You've done a great job in posing these questions. So the first question we have before us is this, Dinesh. Before starting a debate with a non-believer, do you think it's important to find out exactly what and why they believe what they believe?
Yes, I do think, well, two things about this. The first is that it's important to capture the thrust of what the other guy is really saying. Look at it from his point of view. And recognize that from his point of view, many of the things that we do believe would sound strange. If somebody were to come from Mars or from Papua New Guinea encountering Christianity for the first time, and if you were to explain to them, it would sound very odd. And we as Christians should recognize that. The second point is that also, though, it's at the same time we should remember that sometimes what people say and what their motives are not the same. There's the preacher John Stott gives the example of a guy who would come to his church every Sunday, and after the service he'd come up to him and say, Pastor John, I got a question for you. And he would answer it, and the next Sunday he'd go, Pastor John, I got a question for you. And after about 8 weeks of this, John Stott said to him, he said, you know what, you've been asking me all these questions. And he said, what if I were to sit you down and answer every single question that you have to your complete satisfaction? Would you then become a Christian? And he says the guy stood up and he kind of smiled and he never came back again. And Stott realized that his real objection really wasn't intellectual. He had some other resistance to Christianity, and that was the real block. The questions were the rationalization for it. So I say this because many times we're dealing with a relative, and in some ways they're rebelling, they're objecting, but you won't convert them until you discover the true ground of their objection, which is not always the stated ground. So I mentioned this just because psychologically you may be dealing with more than just answering the objection. You may also be dealing with an anger at God over something that's happened in this person's life. And ultimately that needs to be addressed also.
Excellent. Next question is prophecy relevant in debating atheists?
I would say, as a general matter, no, because here we get to the strength and the limits of apologetics. Apologetics is ultimately, you're operating in the terrain of reason. You're operating in the terrain of what can be shown by reason. And sometimes, in doing that, I'll even make statements that sort of shock the atheist a little bit. One time this guy said to me, all these believers, and he said, I don't even like the atheists. He said, the atheists say there's no God. The believer says there's a God. He goes, I'm an agnostic. I don't know. And I said to him, I said, well, you should get off your moral high horse, because I said, I'm an agnostic too. And he was shocked. And I said, well, I said, in a certain way, I said, if you think about it, I said, I don't know either. I said, I believe, but belief is not the same as knowledge. Okay, I have a brother, and I wouldn't say, you know, I believe in my brother. I would say, I know the guy. The reason you believe in something is because you don't know. Belief implies lack of certain knowledge. In fact, faith is valuable because you don't know. Christ himself said when the people touched his hands, they knew he had come back. But Christ found that less creditable than the guys who believed even though they weren't sure. They hadn't seen Christ. So the point I'm getting at is I disarm the agnostic by saying you don't have any moral high ground. In fact, if you're asking me what comes after death, I have no clue. But quite frankly, you don't either. Now, here's the thing. You're acting as though there's no life after death. You're acting as though your position is based on reason. And my position is based on faith. Not true. Both our positions are based on faith. You haven't been to the dead and come back, and neither have I. The fact is, this is in the domain of the unknown. We are both making a judgment based on our best assessment of what is likely to be the case. So my point is, you're taking away the atheist's idea that he's being reasonable, and you're being dogmatic. You're basically saying, we're both in the dark. We're both on an even plane intellectually. Now, we might know by faith, but I'm not using that weapon in this debate. I'm simply confining it to the limited domain of reason.
Excellent. Next question is, how do atheists explain our view of man's inherent sinful nature?
Here is the great irony that atheism takes different shapes and forms, but today's atheism, a lot of it is rooted in Darwinism. A lot of it is anchored in the sort of Darwinian view of human nature. And weirdly, the Darwinian view of human nature and the Christian view of human nature are similar. In fact, I would say that the two of them are to be distinguished from what can be called the liberal view of human nature. Essentially, the liberal view of human nature is that human nature is wonderful. And that if you give people freedom, they will use it well. The Darwinian view of human nature is that's not the case. Human beings are selfish. They are oriented toward essentially accumulating power to survival. And the Darwinian view is, you might say, the low view of human nature, which also happens to be the Christian view. that human nature is bent. Immanuel Kant says, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. That's the Christian view. Oddly enough, there is some common ground between the Darwinian and the Christian view of human nature, although the remedies for this problem differ a lot.
Absolutely. Next question. Given that God and heaven are infinite and exist outside of time and space, how then is it written by John that time and space are introduced by God's proclamation that there will be a half hour of silence in heaven?
Next. Okay. I'll offer two thoughts about this. One is the idea of a God outside of space and time is so difficult for us to apprehend that the Bible, and indeed all of Christian literature, deals with God in, you can say, metaphorical terms. He was sitting at the right hand of God. God becomes jealous and angry and so on. Now, in a certain sense, from a theological point of view, we are understanding God, you might say, in human terms. It's almost as if God was a great grandfather. It's almost as if God was a patriarch. These must be understood as limited human ways of comprehending what God really is. And once we see that, we don't fall in the trap of seeing God as an extension of us. God is in some ways beyond our comprehension. We're using the limited tools of language and our own comprehension to understand God. But now, having said this, I think this is actually, I'm here borrowing from C.S. Lewis, a good way to sort of understand God's role in the universe. C.S. Lewis says that the universe is a little bit like, let's say, the play Hamlet. And in the play, there's causality, right? Hamlet's mother conspiring, Gertrude conspires to kill his father. So there's causal action in the play. But then there's also a cause of the play, Mr. William Shakespeare. He's outside the play. And in some ways, it is foolish to say, when C.S. Lewis says, when people say, I'm looking for evidence of God in the universe. Years ago, the Russians, they sent a cosmonaut into space, and he came back and issued a press release. Hey, I've been looking out there. There's no God. You know. And C.S. Lewis comments that that would be a little bit like Hamlet, saying, you know, I've searched all through my castles. I've looked all over Denmark. I just haven't found Shakespeare. Well, Shakespeare is a cause of the play at a totally different level than the action internal to the play. So the idea here is that God outside of space and time operates in a completely different zone than the action within space and time. But, C.S. Lewis said, there is nothing to stop the author from writing himself into the plot. So if the author decides, oh, you know what, I kind of would like to have my wife, Judith Shakespeare, I'm going to put her into the narrative. Oh, I'm going to go into it myself. In other words, it's God's creation, and he can intervene in it if he wishes. So there's no contradiction between God being outside of space and time, I'm the author of the play, and saying, you know what, I'm also going to emerge, let's say, through Jesus, as a character in the play. Those two things are not contradictory in any way.
Great. Amen. Next question we have is, what do you say to someone who asks, how do you know that Jesus lived?
This is a very good question. Hitchens, in his book, God is Not Great, says, Jesus is probably a myth. And his reasoning is, he says, look, we got these ancient documents. How do we know Jesus existed? Basically, because four guys say so. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And quite frankly, it's not even four guys, because a couple of the guys copied from the other two guys. So really, two guys say so. And besides, we can't really believe what they say, because they are devotees. They are not objective observers. They are not hostile witnesses. They are admiring new Christians. And so you can fully expect them to exaggerate and make a bunch of stuff up in order to spread the word, you might say. Okay, well, now, the way to counter this, by the way, again, how to think like an atheist. Say to yourself, what are we getting at here? What's the issue being examined? The issue being examined is the historicity of people who lived a long time ago. That's the issue. So, my answer to Hitchens in the debate went as follows. I say to him, okay, there's not a teacher of philosophy in America alive who does not believe that Socrates existed. Socrates is the founder of Western philosophy. Yet, how do we know that Socrates existed? Turns out, there are only two sources, Plato and Xenophon, both admiring students of Socrates, right? And who give contradictory pictures of him. Socrates in his lifetime never wrote a word. We have not a single writing by him. And yet, as I say, there is no doubt in any educated mind that there was a fellow, ugly, poor, who walked in the streets of Athens asking people irritating questions named Socrates. So why is there such a strong belief in that guy? Or to go further, how do we know Alexander the Great existed? How do we know that any figure of the ancient world existed? The truth of it is, the records of those things are pretty limited. The general assumption in history is that if you find information, you presume it to be true unless there's strong evidence to the contrary. You don't need to corroborate it independently. If I'm digging in Egypt and I take out a coffin, here lies the tomb of Tutankhamen. What do I conclude? Well, there probably was a guy named Tutankhamen who was buried in this tomb. I don't say, the people who did this are lying, and now I've got to find independent corroboration, otherwise I can presume that this is all a fakery. If I have independent reason to think it's fake, like, for example, I date the tomb and it turns out to be only 40 years old, then I know something's amiss. So the point I'm getting at here is this, and that is that, what I'm getting at here is that almost all our evidence for the ancient world is based on a standard of historical evidence. The Bible more than meets that standard, because in the case of Christ, you not only have the four Gospels, you have the testimony of the Jewish historian Josephus, you have Greek historians, you have Roman sources, all of whom can, in fact, one good example is the Roman historian Tacitus, who was basically a court historian. Tacitus writes, and he doesn't even care about Christianity. He's writing in the center of the empire. He goes, you know, there's a big nuisance going on in one corner of the empire. This crazy guy, Christus, is stirring up the mob. He goes, fortunately, we've grabbed the bandit. We've got him crucified. Hopefully the whole thing will die down over there. Now, this is a very reliable witness, because here's a guy who's against the Christians. He's talking about this guy, Christ, who's causing trouble. He's confirming the crucifixion, and he doesn't care one way or the other. To him, it's just a little nuisance in the periphery of the empire. So what I'm saying is, by normal historical standards, there's great evidence for the historicity of Christ. So I say, so what about this Socrates business, Hitchens? So he goes, well, he says, Socrates' views stand on their own merits. It doesn't really matter whether he existed or not. His ideas stand. So I say, look, we're not debating the merits of his philosophy any more than we're debating the teachings of Jesus Christ. You may think they're great. You may think they're sick and demented. We're discussing whether those guys actually walked about. We're discussing historicity. So this is what happens in the debate, is your opponent, when he finds himself on weaker ground, changes the topic and introduces a new standard. And you got to kind of be alert for that. So you say, okay, we can debate that tomorrow. But today you've raised the issue of, was there a fellow named Christ who lived? And I think on that you've got to concede that I've kind of got you on that one.
Amen. So...
This is the end of this message. If you'd like further information on any of our products, visit the Word for Today's Online Resource Center at twft.com. You may also write us at P.O. Box 8000, Costa Mesa, California, 92628. Our toll-free number is 1-800-272-WORD. That's 1-800-272-WORD.